good evening. The market slumped despite an emergency interest rate reduction. What's happening on Wall Street? Afghan peace agreement, can it hold? And a hero of Puerto Rican independence dies. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with some of the news for Tuesday, March 3rd, 2020. Stocks fell sharply in volatile trading on Tuesday as an emergency rate cut by the Federal Reserve failed to bring confidence to a market traumatized by rapidly falling prices and virus-borne pandemic with no end in sight. The Federal Reserve announced an emergency rate cut of half a percentage point this morning in response to the growing economic threat from the novel coronavirus. The move was the first such cut since December 2008 during the financial crisis. The Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell at a news conference earlier today.
Earlier today, the Federal Open Market Committee announced a 1/2 percentage point reduction in the target range for the federal funds rate, bringing that range to 1 to 1.25%. My colleagues and I took this action to help the U.S. economy keep strong in the face of new risks to the economic outlook. The fundamentals of the U.S. economy remain strong. The unemployment rate has been near half-century lows for well more than a year. The pace of job gains has been solid, and wages have been rising. These strong labor market conditions have underpinned solid household spending, which has been the key driver of economic growth over the past year. At the time of our FOMC meeting in January, prospects for continued economic growth remained favorable, and we judged that monetary policy was well positioned to support that outlook. Since then, the spread of the coronavirus has brought new challenges and risks. The virus has afflicted many communities around the world, and our thoughts and prayers go out to those who've been harmed. The outbreak has also disrupted economic activity in many countries and has prompted significant movements in financial markets. The virus and the measures that are being taken to contain it will surely weigh on economic activity, both here and abroad, for some time. We are beginning to see the effects on the tourism and travel industries, and we are hearing concerns from industries that rely on global supply chains. The magnitude and persistence of the overall effects on the economy, however, remain highly uncertain, and the situation remains a fluid one. Against this background, the committee judged that the risks to the U.S. outlook have changed materially. In response, we have eased the stance of monetary policy to provide some more support to the economy. Of course, the ultimate solutions to this challenge will come from others, particularly health professionals. We can and will do our part, however, to keep the U.S. economy strong as we meet this challenge. As always, our actions are guided by our congressional mandate to promote maximum employment and price stability. In the weeks and months ahead, we will continue to closely monitor developments and their implications for the economic outlook. And we will use our tools and act as appropriate to support the economy.
And the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed 785 points down, a loss of more than 3%. Meanwhile, U.S. Treasury bonds, a safe haven in troubled times, saw its yield drop below 1% for the first time in history. President Trump is a big fan of continued interest rate cuts by the Fed. He tweeted this morning, "The Federal Reserve is cutting but must further ease and most importantly come into line with other countries' competitors. We are not playing on a level field, not fair to USA. It's finally time for the Federal Reserve to lead more easing and cutting." Meanwhile, more than 89,000 coronavirus cases have been confirmed globally, along with more than 3,000 deaths related to the virus. In New York City, a Yeshiva University student has been quarantined in his family's suburban home with symptoms of coronavirus. His father tested positive for the potentially deadly disease. The man's wife and another child, who attends a private Jewish school in Riverdale, are also isolated in the house. The Yeshiva student is suspected of getting the illness from his dad, who on Tuesday became the state's second confirmed case of coronavirus, but the first believed to have been infected through community contact. So far, there are 104 confirmed cases of coronavirus in the United States. 9 have died, and more cases are expected. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo earlier today.
We have a case in Westchester, a 50-year-old gentleman who did not travel to any of the places that are on the watch list, did travel to Miami, but that is not a place that we have known that there's any cluster of coronavirus. And he has tested positive, lives in Westchester, has been with his family in Westchester. So we are now going through possible connections to track down possible connections to find people. The SAR school in Riverdale closed. That is today. That's a school that one of the children attended. There may be some more schools that voluntarily close just until they determine exactly if there were children who might have exposed other children, because you have to now track back all of these situations. The gentleman had, our information is the underlying respiratory illness, and he is ill, and he is hospitalized. That's juxtaposed with the case we talked about yesterday, which was a 39-year-old healthcare worker who is positive, but she's at home. She's not even hospitalized. And they said, why isn't she hospitalized? Because she has mild symptoms, right?
In a press briefing Tuesday afternoon, Dr. Nancy Messonnier, the director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention and the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases, confirmed her initial prediction that there will be more coronavirus cases in the U.S. and likely from a mix of contact and community spread, as well as potentially from unknown sources. The United Nations World Health Organization has been holding daily news briefings on the coronavirus. Its director general is Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus. He says the disease has led to disruptions in the supply of protective gear for health workers, and the UN cannot handle the problem alone.
But we're concerned that countries' abilities to respond are being compromised by the severe and increasing disruption to the global supply of personal protective equipment caused by rising demand, hoarding, and misuse. Shortages are leaving doctors, nurses, and other frontline health workers dangerously ill-equipped to care for COVID-19 patients due to limited access to supplies such as gloves, medical masks, respirators, goggles, face shields, gowns, and aprons. We can't stop COVID-19 without protecting our health workers. Prices of surgical masks have increased sixfold, and 95 respirators have more than tripled, and gowns cost twice as much. Supplies can take months to deliver. Market manipulation is widespread, and stocks are often sold to the highest bidder. WHO has shipped nearly 500,000 sets of personal protective equipment to 27 countries. But supplies are rapidly depleting. WHO estimates that each month, 89 million medical masks will be required for the COVID-19 response, 76 million examination gloves, and 1.6 million goggles. WHO has guidelines on how to rationalize the use of personal protective equipment in health facilities and manage supply chains effectively. We're also working with governments, manufacturers, and the pandemic supply chain network to boost production and secure supplies for critically affected and at-risk countries. Globally, it's estimated that PPE supplies need to be increased by 40%. We continue to call on manufacturers to urgently increase production to meet this demand and guarantee supplies. And we have called on governments to develop incentives for manufacturers to ramp up production. This includes easing restrictions on the export and distribution of personal protective equipment and other medical supplies. Once again, this is a question for solidarity. This cannot be solved by WHO alone or one industry alone. It requires all of us working together to ensure all countries can protect the people who protect the rest of us.
Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus is Director General of the World Health Organization. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. We have joining us on the line economist Jack Rasmus. Welcome to WBAI, Professor Rasmus.
Glad to be with you.
Glad to have you on. So we went off a little on the side talking about Afghanistan. We'll come back to that in a minute. You have been following what's happening on Wall Street, and let me go with you and just ask you what's really happening with the markets.
Well, you know, what's really happening is that the Federal Reserve reduces interest rates by 50 basis points, and it was half of 1%, and the markets still continue to collapse. What that really means that the Fed move on interest rates have absolutely no effect on the economy going forward. It might stimulate a little more refinancing of mortgages, but investors know that it's going to have no effect. And in contrast, you know, the virus effect and the ending or severing of supply chains going on and the decline in consumption and certain industries like travel and hotels and so forth. This is what's really driving the stock market and what's really causing it to collapse here. And what the investors are saying is that, hey, look, you know, corporate earnings are going to take a big dive, and the economy is going to contract in the U.S. So we may be at the beginning, the early stage of the recession already. We'll see at the end of March what the real numbers say. But investors are saying, look, you know, this move by the Federal Reserve is going to have no effect, not even on financial markets anymore. And what you're going to see is politicians are going to start talking about more tax cuts, even though Trump gave him trillions of dollars in 2018 and another 420.
Uh-huh.
Jack, so
yes.
The answer you're going to get on the fiscal side is more tax cuts, which won't.
What kind of tax cuts are they talking about?
Okay, they're talking about, one, making the 2018 tax cuts.
We're losing you there.
That's like $4.5 trillion over the next decade, and they want to make it permanent. They want to index capital gains to inflation. In other words, automatic tax cuts by indexing it to inflation.
What effect would having these kind of tax cuts have on the economy and on the people of the United States?
Absolutely nothing on the economy. You know, we've got hundreds of billions of tax cuts under Trump in the last 2 years, and real investment has been contracting for 9 months, and manufacturing recession. And when you start getting layoffs pretty soon, there goes the consumer. It will have absolutely no effect, just as it has had no effect, except to boost finance. And now that's not going to happen.
What can we expect? I mean, is this a crash? I mean, people are talking in fearful tones. I mean, is this something to fear, or is it just something where the elites are just having another headache?
No, it's potentially something very serious. It's what they call a black swan, comes out of nowhere. What's really serious is that the financial asset markets, not just stocks, but you see oil, you see futures, you see commodities, currencies, if these all start going south, then you're going to have the possibility of defaults in junk bonds and leveraged loans, which means the energy industry and retail, and then you could be back towards massive layoffs, and you could be, I'm not saying it will be, but you could be right back where we were in 2008-09.
A lot of people say that was the end of the economy.
They bailed out the banks. It cost them $5 trillion by the Federal Reserve. The Fed is ready to pump more free. That won't work.
Donald Trump has a lot of excuses for why the economy, you know, he's basing his whole life on his whole career on the economy and how well the stock market's doing. What does that say about his policies up till now?
What it means is the stock market is not the be-all and end-all of the economy. Main Street is the economy. And that pumping up the stock market to artificial levels with these excess free money, trillions of dollars for investors, has done nothing for the real economy, and now the stock market is precipitated. It's too high, and now it's going to come down faster than it went up.
All right. Thank you very much. Economist Jack Rasmus discussing the condition of the stock market, which has lost a large percentage of its gains in just the last few days. Today, there was another collapse in the prices of stocks of nearly 800 points, the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Donald Trump said today that he's spoken by telephone to a senior Taliban official. The conversation between Trump and the head of the Taliban's political office, Abdul Ghani Baradar, was the first direct exchange between a U.S. president and the insurgent leadership since the U.S. military intervention in Afghanistan began in 2001. The Taliban reported the call with the delegation in Doha, and it lasted 35 minutes. They claimed that Trump told Baradar, "You are tough people and have a great country, and I understand that you are fighting for your homeland. We have been there for 19 years, and that is a very long time, and withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan is in the interest of everyone." The U.S. has on Saturday signed two agreements, one with the Taliban offering the full withdrawal of foreign troops in 14 months if the insurgents take part in comprehensive intra-Afghan peace talks. Matthew Ho, a senior fellow with the Center for International Policy, he has nearly 12 years experience with America's wars overseas with the United States Marine Corps, Department of Defense, and State Department. Ho says Trump pulled off something that President Barack Obama and George W. Bush could have if they wanted.
There have been a number of instances where Taliban interlocutors have attempted negotiation. They have reached out through media sources in Central Asia and the Middle East. They've reached out through other countries, and they have constantly been rebuffed by the United States. The United States has wanted victory, military victory in Afghanistan. And President Trump, I am not a fan of President Trump by far, by any means. This is probably the only thing I have given him credit for in 3 years. However, he did instruct his special representative to speak to the Taliban. And within a year, because this is the same deal that was available to have been signed back in September, a deal was struck with the Taliban. And so what's so tragic about this is that this is something that literally could have occurred at any other point over the last 20 years. And you see it in the fact that all that had to happen was us to talk to the Taliban for a negotiated settlement to begin. Now, this is just the beginning of it. This is just the first phase of a peace deal or a peace process. But again, it's at least the first phase. It's something that hasn't occurred in Afghanistan since 1989.
What's kept things from reaching this point, and what did Trump do different?
The desire for the United States to have military victory
in
Afghanistan.
What would that look like in Afghanistan, military victory?
Military victory would be subjugating the Pashtun people. The Pashtun people make up 40% of the Afghan population. They overwhelmingly represent the Taliban. For the majority of the 40 years or 40 plus years of fighting in Afghanistan, and this war goes back prior to the Soviet Union's invasion. A lot of people like to say it started when the Soviets invaded, but by the time the Soviets invade in December of 1979, already 100,000 Afghans have been killed in fighting in Afghanistan. But victory would have looked as if the Taliban had put down their weapons. The Pashtun people had surrendered, basically, to the other ethnicities of the country to the north. This is no different than the way the United States wars are around the world. And I believe it's correct to call the last 20 years the Third World War. Because if you look at these wars, they extend from Western Africa now all the way through Pakistan. And at times they have been involved, say, in places like the Philippines as well. Trump escalated the war in Afghanistan so that basically he could beat his chest, say he's been tougher on the Taliban than Obama was. Then he instructed Khalilzad to go and negotiate with the Taliban. And again, within the span of a year, the deal was set to be signed, and it would have been signed last September. But then that fell through because, you know, for lack of a better term, President Trump had a temper tantrum. The deal that was signed last month in February in Doha, Qatar, between the United States and the Taliban was the exact same deal that could have been signed back in September.
To be about Donald Trump, President Trump's desire to save face and to look good for his reelection more than anything from his perspective.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, absolutely is about Donald Trump's reelection.
What happens next?
What's next is supposed to be negotiations between the Afghan government and the Taliban to bring about a ceasefire and then a power-sharing agreement. And if that's successful, then all U.S. forces will leave in 14 months. Whether or not that includes the CIA, that's another that we don't know. So you're seeing the government split. We may have there may be two parallel governments in Afghanistan. There are certainly Taliban splinter groups that don't want peace. Certainly the Islamic State is not included in this deal. And for those in Afghanistan, the warlords and the drug lords who have seen their power grow, who have seen themselves get rich, who have seen themselves control territory because of the war, they are very loath to lose this war because they are benefiting from it, whether it be because of the power or because of the money. So there's a lot of factors here. There's a lot of people who it benefits for this war not to end in Afghanistan as well, too, here in the United States. Certainly the American weapon companies have no interest in seeing this war end.
Matthew Ho is a senior fellow with the Center for International Policy. In related news, discrepancy between the two peace agreements with the Taliban have become apparent. The deal with the Taliban states that up to 5,000 Taliban and up to 1,000 government soldiers would be released by March 10th when intra-Afghan negotiations are due to start. The Afghan government has said it had not agreed to the release of 5,000 Taliban fighters before talks with the insurgents begin. According to the Taliban account of Tuesday's phone call, Trump assured Baradar that he had asked his Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to talk to the Afghan President Ashraf Ghani in order to remove all hurdles facing the intra-Afghan negotiations and promise U.S. aid for Afghan reconstruction. And today is Super Tuesday. The Democratic Party primaries held in 14 states and one overseas U.S. territory that elects one-third of all the delegates that choose the presidential candidate of the party at the nominating convention in Milwaukee this summer. These are the first primaries since last week's South Carolina contest that former Vice President Joe Biden won handily with deep support among African-American voters. Frontrunner Bernie Sanders came in a distant second. Since South Carolina, two more would-be candidates have dropped out. South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, I should say three, Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar and billionaire Tom Steyer. Buttigieg and Klobuchar have both thrown their support to Biden. Biden is expecting to benefit from his South Carolina win tonight, and nearly half of those polled say they made up their minds in the last few days. Majorities in both states say they would prefer a nominee who can beat President Donald Trump over one with whom they agree on the issues. Branko Marcetic is author of the recently released book, Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. He says Biden, if nominated, will lose to Trump in the same way Hillary Clinton lost in 2016.
Joe Biden has every weakness that Hillary Clinton had against Donald Trump, but turned up to 11, not just on the sort of corruption element, but terrible record on criminal justice, a hawkish war record, particularly as the architect of the Iraq War, has tried for decades to try and cut Social Security and Medicare, the thing that Trump ran against in 2016. Also a poor record on social issues like abortion and marriage equality. Basically everything that depressed Democratic turnout in 2016 and also led to some people to switch from voting Democratic to go to Trump, Biden has that in spades, including the trade deals that he supported, NAFTA, TPP, that kind of thing.
Basically a swamp creature in the lexicon of the Trump people.
Not just the swamp, but also, you know, policies that have consistently benefited corporate America and sort of worked to help Republicans roll back the New Deal and Great Society over time. You know, and that is a result of the fact that, on the one hand, yes, Biden has gotten lots of contributions from corporate sources, including in Delaware, of course, the credit card company MBNA was his biggest contributor throughout his career. And, of course, that's why he pushed the bankruptcy bill that he did that hurt so many middle-class families.
What did that do? What did his credit card reform bill do?
The bankruptcy bill basically made it a lot harder for middle-class families to declare bankruptcy, to sort of get rid of their debts that they were saddled with. There were bankruptcy judges who were talking about how the bill was terribly written and flawed. This was pushed by the credit card industry, including MBNA, which again was the top contributor for Biden through his career, because at the time, a lot of the bankruptcies that were happening through the 90s and even today, they were related to credit card debt. Credit card debt was going up from the 90s onwards.
What about the Gulf War?
He was one of the, not just a supporter, he was one of the key architects of that war. He was the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in that period. He actually held hearings on the Iraq War in the lead-up, where he basically just stacked the witness list with people who were pro-Iraq War, who said that there was a link between Saddam and al-Qaeda, who said that Iraq definitely had weapons of mass destruction. And in fact, Biden actually opened those hearings with a statement basically saying that Saddam had to be gotten rid of. He didn't call in people like Scott Ritter, who were critics of the Bush push to war, who were more skeptical of these claims.
What explains his support among African Americans, especially in South Carolina?
Part of it is pragmatism. I think the other thing is that Biden has had this kind of aura of electability that has been pushed by the media and by his surrogates and by the Democratic Party as a whole. On MSNBC, throughout 2019, that was the narrative that was being pushed. It wasn't about his policies. It wasn't about his record. It was just about who is the most electable. And, of course, people would cite polls to say this. And, of course, the polls change, but this is certainly the thing that was being fed to voters. So I think a lot of voters, African-American voters who want to get rid of Trump, believe Biden's the best bet. And also Biden has, quite paradoxically, but he has had a lot of loyalty from African-American voters over the decades in Delaware and elsewhere.
What about the Ukraine allegations by Trump? Do you think that Trump has anything on Biden?
It's hard to say. There's so much information whizzing in either direction. I will say this. There was a report by Novaya Gazeta, which is an independent Russian newspaper. It's anti-Putin. It was cited many times by liberals in the U.S. because it was this anti-Putin newspaper in Russia. And it reported that the investigation into Burisma was still ongoing when the prosecutor Shokin was fired by Biden. Whether Biden did it to protect his son, that's a whole other matter. But it does suggest that the case is a little more complicated than the media in the U.S. is making it appear. I mean, I think it's also important to note the prosecutor who replaced Shokin, who was supposedly fired because he was too corrupt, he himself had a record of corruption. So there's things in the story that don't add up. I think beyond this, though, fundamentally, is that what the story is about is we can talk about whether Trump should have used his office to sort of, and foreign aid to basically help his own campaign. But at the same time, the matter here is that Biden's son ended up on the board of this company as it was launching a lobbying campaign in the United States. And as Biden was the point man for the Obama administration in Ukraine, there's a lot of corruption that goes on in D.C. that is completely fine and legal, as we know, through campaign contributions. So fundamentally, as the voters keep hearing about this for the next however many months, I think it's going to be particularly conducive for a Democratic win in November.
Branko Marcetic is author of the recently released book, Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. And Puerto Rican independence activist Rafael Cancel Miranda died Monday at the age of 89. He passed away at his residence in Rio Piedras in the municipality of San Juan. That was according to his widow, Maria, and his youngest son, Rafael Cancel Jr. He had been hospitalized in San Juan for several weeks, according to his family. Rafael Cancel Miranda was born in the town of Mayagüez on July 18, 1930, and was one of the main leaders of the Puerto Rican independence movement and the Puerto Rico Nationalist Party, which he joined at age 15. Rafael was the last survivor of the four militant nationalists who on March 1, 1954, shot at members of the U.S. House of Representatives to protest U.S. colonial rule over Puerto Rico. The assault on the U.S. Congress earned him a quarter century in jail and boundless veneration for the Puerto Rican independence movement. The Puerto Rican independence movement considered Rafael Cancel Miranda one of the top figures of the 20th century, along with Pedro Albizu Campos, Lolita Lebron, Juan Marie Bras, Filiberto Ojeda Rios, and Gilberto Concepcion de Gracia for the participation in the attack on Congress in 1954. WBAI's Sally O'Brien sent us the interview, wrote this introduction with Rafael Cancel Miranda.
My name is Rafael Cancel Miranda. An ex-political prisoner, nationalist, Puerto Rican nationalist, fighting for the independence for my country, Puerto Rico.
And you have been fighting for your country for your entire life, and how old are you now?
I'm 83 now, and I was even 7 years old when the massacre, Ponce massacre, because my parents were survivors of the Ponce massacre. I was close to 7 years old, and since then, I've been fighting for the right of my people to be free. Well, it's a long story.
Looking at the situation in Puerto Rico right now, the statistics are saying that there are more Puerto Ricans in the United States than there are in the island of Puerto Rico, particularly since Fortunio's administration. And I'm wondering if in all of these years of struggling for independence, if you've seen a time quite like this before.
Well, not quite like this. And Dan Fortunio is one of the luckiest. It is not a matter of Fortunio, Garcia Padilla, one of them colonial governor. It's the fact that we are a colony. And that's the council that created the situation. Don't matter who is the lucky, they had the colonial government. It is the situation that they destroy our economy, you know. And they are doing to my people just like they did in New Zealand, in Rhodesia, in South Africa, Australia, taking our people away from our whole land, what they are coming in, you know. And that's what worries me, that the way things go, they might not be Puerto Rican here in 50 years or so, because they displacing our people. Right now there is more people out of Puerto Rico than in Puerto Rico. And that's not supposed to be. That's not supposed to be, you know. But it is because the crisis we have. Because remember, the ones to blame about this crisis are the United States interest, the center of power, that they control our economy. They destroy our agriculture. We used to produce more than 75% of what we consume. Now we have to buy to them 85% of what we consume. They have made us dependent. They destroy our culture. They take away from Puerto Rico 85,000 million from the agriculture that we had to buy to them, what we used to produce ourselves. So there we lost 85 billion a year. And they destroy our economy, our Puerto Rican business. They brought their transnational, their, you know, so-called mega tiendas, and they destroy our economy. They take out from Puerto Rico every year, the big companies, like Walmart and all that, more than 35 billion a year. But not only that, see, they destroy our economy completely. They destroy 400 community pharmacies to bring their Walgreens, and so that was create the situation that we are right now, and getting the so-called colonial government in debt, more than 70 billion in debt. But they create the situation, not the Puerto Rican people. They create the situation because we are a colony of the United States. See, and you know that when an empire go into a country to exploit that country. And they've been doing that to Puerto Rican people, are forcing us out of our homeland. Not because the Puerto Rican wanted to go to the ghettos of New York or Chicago anywhere, because they are forced to, while they are coming in. In Vieques, right now, half of the population are from the United States. And in Culebra, more than half of the population of the United States. In my mother town, already there are 20% of the people population are from the United States, North America, from the United States. So it's, what I see in the future is not too good for my people. We will keep fighting until the end, because we have the right to fight back and to do whatever we have to do to be free.
And how do you see the Puerto Rican people being able to set up a separate economy from that imposed by the United States?
The only way is becoming a free country to have the power. There are at least 25 absolute power they have over my country. They even said 7 or 8 years ago that they could sell us to China, to Japan, to Germany, to any country like they used to sell a slave. They tell us 7 or 8 years ago, that's an insult.
Who is the they?
That was in the Bush time, when Bush was there. George Bush, this criminal war, because he's a war criminal. You know, no matter what, anybody, he's a war criminal. You know, and one of their delegates from Bush said in a report on Puerto Rico that the so-called White House did, they said that they could even sold us without even asking us to any country that we were a slave. Who the hell they think they are? Because they said we are a property. We are not part of the United States. They say we are a property, and we don't want to be part of the United States. We want to be Puerto Rican. This is our homeland. That's it.
There's a lot of people who don't understand. They think, well, Puerto Rico is a commonwealth of the United States. Other people say free association. But exactly how? How does the United States control the government of Puerto Rico?
They control land, sea, communications, the commercial, everything. And we took it to the UN a few years back. Of the 25 different absolute power, immigration, they control everything. We could not trade to other countries, only they give us permission. We don't have no power. And that's our crisis. We don't have no power to solve our problem. We don't have the power to avoid the crisis, and we don't have the power to solve the crisis, because they have the power. They have the power.
Are you hopeful that there can be a revolution in Puerto Rico? I mean, how do you see the state of the independence movement at this point?
My hope is that we be free, in friendly way to everyone who respects us. But I think that inside the United States, there has to be a revolution. Inside the United States itself, because they abuse 47 million people. Don't have no health care in the United States. 47 million people. And how many are living on the poverty line in the United States? Who control the United States? That few minority that Eisenhower said, the military industrial, they are the real power in the United States. Barack Obama is just a resident of the White House. He's not a president of the White House. He's just a resident there who take orders from the national security, from the CIA, from whatever. You know what I mean. And there is something that Puerto Rican has paid a high price that is more valuable than money. Puerto Rican life. They invade my country first, May 12, 1898. The United States Navy bombed Puerto Rico from the sea, killing many Puerto Ricans. May 12, 1898, under order from Samson, Admiral Samson, killing Puerto Ricans in the street, in their houses, destroying buildings, everything. 2 months later, they invade my country, July 25th, 1898. Then, in 1917, they imposed their citizenship against the will of the Puerto Rican people. The Puerto Rican government did not want the United States citizenship. They imposed it. Woodrow Wilson was the president. And 2 months later, after they imposed their citizenship, I'm Puerto Rican. My only citizenship, Puerto Rican, that I could not travel right now because I don't use their passport. You know, I could not travel no more. But anyway, they control immigration. They impose, they could put any military bases in Puerto Rico without our consent. Even the minimum salary, everything, they control. But I was saying, they bomb my country, right? They invade my country. Then, 1917, March, they imposed the citizenship against the will of the Puerto Rican government. Then 2 months later, they imposed the military service, and that cost Puerto Rican many thousands of died. Young people who died in all kinds of wars the United States have of aggression in Vietnam, in Korea, whatever, in Iraq, everywhere. They sent Puerto Rican to kill and die for those few ones who control the United States, not for the Puerto Rican people. So we have been paying a high price for being a colony in the United States. We have been paying a high price. I hope, and that's why I'm fighting for, I hope that someday we could be a free country in friendship with everyone, including the United.
And of course, the enforcement of this colonialism, unfortunately, is seen in the hands of Puerto Rican people who have jobs as police, as military, and all of that kind of thing. And I'm wondering if effective media campaigns and that kind of thing could help educate people so that they wouldn't participate in that kind of thing.
Too, Sally, you have a list of how they colonize our mind. They control all the means of mass communication. They control the school. The first time they throw me out of school, I was 7 years old after the Ponce massacre. They want me to split to the United States flag because we are children. They start deforming our loyalties. They've been colonized, you and you are a kid. I couldn't understand the colonized mind, because it's easy. When they control everything, they create dependency in my country. 44% of my people have to live on food stamps. They impose that on my country. My country don't used to live on food stamps, but they control. They make us dependent, and there is no other type of slave than being dependent, because they tie you up. May you pray of being free. The miracle in Puerto Rico is that there be still Puerto Rican fighting for independence and believing in oneself. That for me is a miracle, that there's still there Puerto Rican who could fight for their freedom, because they've been taking our pride away from us. And once you lost your pride, even a cutthroat could control you. You know, they try to smack that pride and make us dependent from them. And that colonize your mind. Don't matter who you are. Only you are open eyes and you can find out the truth. What? Let me tell you something, too. They impose the military service. And when I was 18 years old, the FBI agent arrested me. Why? They want me to go kill Korean people. Why should I should kill Korean people? Or say they invade my country. Puerto Rico is my home. The Puerto Rican are my family. They assault my country, kill my people. They massacred us in October 24, 1935, under order from Colonel Ricks. And they massacred us in March 25, 1937, under order from Blanton Winship. And they still want me to go to and be part of the same gang of delinquents who killed my people and assault my country. I refused. And they gave me 2 years. And they put me in a plane and sent me to a prison in the United States. And many other Puerto Ricans have been in prison for that. We have been forced to kill and die for the same one who killed us and robbed my people and my country. Then, you know, the other time in March 12, 1954, what happened in Washington. At that time, up to 1953, they had to report to the United Nations about Puerto Rico, because Puerto Rico was in a committee of dependent territory.
Right.
So the United States...
The decolonization committee.
The colonization. So they had to report to the UN every year. They don't want it to do no more. Then they said, at the UN, I was there, they said that we Puerto Rican freely vote for the Estado Libre Asociado. And that's not true. We Puerto Rican, I used to be there at the UN then, said that only the free people could freely vote. You have to be free to have a free vote. And Puerto Rico was not free and is not free. We are under military occupation from the United States. We are a kidnapped country. So that's why we went March 5, 1954 to Washington. Lolita Lebron, Andrés Figueroa Cordero, and Floyd Rodriguez, and myself. I was 23 years way back then. Because they deceived their own people. So we went there to make a demonstration that called the attention of the whole world about the reality that we were still a colony. And we still are a colony. See, but that's why I went to Washington in March 1, 1954 and shoot at the Congress of the United States. They've been killing my people from the sea, the U.S. Navy, they massacred us. But look, like when they shoot at people, they do it in a democratic way. But if you shoot back, then you are a terrorist.
And of course, this is going to broadcast in New York and hopefully other places. Of course, in New York, there's a very large Puerto Rican population and a lot of very successful and wealthy Puerto Ricans as well. If they're listening to this program right now, what would you like to say to them?
Oh, well, find out who are you. Find out that you are a Puerto Rican, you got history. And you talk about wealthy Puerto Rican, there might be one, a few, or ten, but still, they will suffer regimes. They have a country, it's Puerto Rico. I hope that don't matter where they be, today, tomorrow, 100 years from now, if they are in the United States, or they be in Europe, or they Africa, Asia, that they still feel proud of their people. We got a history, we've been fighting for our freedom, we regret that they had to leave their country, our country. But I ask them never to bow their head to no one. you know, to be proud Puertorican. Don't matter where they are, if they are poor, if they are rich, whatever. They are a greater thing than just having money. If you lost that sense of dignity, don't matter how much money you have, you are worthless. Because people really count for what they are, not for what they have. You know, and I hope they first be person of dignity, respecting themselves and respecting others, rather than being rich. You could be poor and be one of the richest men on earth if you have dignity and values, moral values. That would really count.
And Don Rafael, finally, there's a lot of young people who are engaging in struggle, who are organizing, who are trying to do stuff both in the United States and here in Puerto Rico. And I'm wondering, with your great experience, what kind of advice you can give to them about the path that they should travel in order to really organize a successful campaign.
Well, there is no magic formula.
No.
I wish there was one magic formula. But to keep on fighting, according to the circumstance of the moment. The time itself dictate what kind of fight you should do. You know, but one thing is for sure. Or you keep on fighting, or you will die as people. There is no other way. There is no other way. They will do to you what they did to the Mexican right now. They took their land from the Mexican land, and then they throw them away from their land back to the alternative. Anything. You are no less than no one. You know, keep fighting way to defend yourself. It is a right we have. Because you don't defend yourself, you are gone. You are gone. And believe me, I wish I was overdoing it. I'm not overdoing it. Because I know the enemy, how they are able to do, how they massacre people in Iraq, massacre children in Libya, in everywhere. They killing children, people, like you know, using now drones, like they say, drones and whatever, killing people. You have a right to protect yourself. You, my brother, even 100 years from now. I wish I'd be there with you wherever you are. I love my people, and I will fight for my people until the end. Thank you.
And that was an interview with Puerto Rican independence leader Rafael Cancel Miranda that was done by WBAI's Sally O'Brien. He passed away earlier this month. And it is 6:52 at 7 p.m. WBAI's Gloria Brown Marshall is co-hosting with WPFW's Verna Avery Brown our live coverage of Super Tuesday results. So stay tuned. By the way, what's your opinion of Super Tuesday? Do you think Super Tuesday is all that super? We got a couple of minutes to take your call. I'm Paul DiRienzo, WBAI News. Our call-in is 212-209-2877. Go to your phone. You should have this already on your quick dial, right? The people who listen to WBAI, you never know when you get an opportunity to put in your 2 cents at 212-209-2877. What do you think of Super Tuesday? Is it really all that super, or is it just another Tuesday to you? Do you think that? Who do you think is going to win it? Do you think it's going to be a Bernie blowout? Is it going to be a Biden? Is Biden coasting on the wave from South Carolina? Will he get the African-American vote so important to winning in the Democratic primaries? Or will it go to whoever's left, I think there's not that many left anymore. I guess it could be the former mayor himself, of New York City, Mayor Bloomberg. So we have somebody on the line. You're on the line. Go ahead. Join us. What do you think of Super Tuesday?
Well, the whole gang, other than Bernie, is trying to get behind a despicable character, the vice president who sat through 8 really quite miserable years for the non-rich of America. Point number one, of course, being the freezing at $7.25 of the slave labor level minimum imposed upon all of us, while the stock markets multiplied by 3.5 times during those 8 years. No objection from Joe Biden. No objection from Joe Biden in a critical action that was taken in the last year of Bill Clinton, namely the killing of Glass Glass-Steagall, which protected us for 66 years, 1933 to 1999, against getting another October 1929, another stock market crash.
Do you see another one of those crashes? You sound like you're educated in economy. Do you see a crash coming, or what's happening right now?
Very, very much so. And by the way, the down in the markets today is because of the horror from the Jeff Bezos and those type of people of the prospect of Bernie coming to the top. They
All right.
know.
Let me leave it at that, Biz. We don't have a lot of time. Thank you very much. We're going to take a call another time. Somebody else on the line? Oh, I'm sorry. Number. I thought there was somebody else on the line. Sorry about that. 212-209-2877 is the number. I thought that was very interesting. And obviously that person had someone a candidate that he seemed to be favoring, Bernie Sanders. Anybody out there, what do you favor? Tell us who you think should win this primary. What's the deal? What's going on? Tell us what you think. 212-209-2877. This is your chance to talk back to the news, right? Usually the news, like me, the news guy, Paul DiRienzo, I'm talking to you. I get to talk to you, to lecture you about what's going on in the world. It's very rare we get a couple of minutes to get your call back here and to tell us what you think. Maybe there's just not that much interest. Maybe this whole election, Donald Trump, everything he's pulled is basically a big ho-hum, and it's only news people like ourselves who really care. Is that what's going on? It could be. I wouldn't be that surprised. You know, we always tend to think of ourselves so importantly. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Am I on?
Yes, go ahead. You're on the radio.
Okay, yeah. I'm hoping Joe Biden wins. I just don't think Sanders can win a general election. So I'm just hoping Joe Biden
wins. Do you think that is? Briefly.
I don't think he can win. I don't think his policies are just way too left wing, and I don't think he's going to connect in the crucial states. That's just what I think.
Right. All right. Very good. I think that's a rational and reasonable point of view to take. But there was also the person we had on earlier who said that Biden's making a lot of the same mistakes that Hillary Clinton did, and nobody thought she would lose. Everybody thought she was eminently electable, as I remember.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
Elections are unpredictable, that's for sure. We have another caller on the line. Thank you very much. You don't have a lot of time. Hi, you're on the air. Question or comment on Super Tuesday.
What's very important is that people check out Black Agenda Report.
Oh, yeah.
Realnews.com, because these super delegates that are going to go to the convention have said 98%, it was reported on Democracy Now!, they're not going to go along with Bernie Sanders unless he wins.
I think that's a very good point. We're going to move on to another call. We don't have a lot of time. Very good point. And you're on the radio.
I wanted to thank you so much for playing that interview. I was just absolutely so riveted and weeping and moved.
Oh, Rafael Cancel Miranda, right?
Oh my God, my good buddy that I grew up with, his dad defended them.
Oh,
when they were. Yeah.
Oh, very good. So let me leave it at that because we'll have to go more into this. Thank you very much for joining us on WBAI. And this is – and finally, that's our end finally. And that's some of the news for March 3rd, 2020. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Stay tuned for WBAI and WPFW's coverage of Super Tuesday.